Up first, getting the hour underway this afternoon, though, we welcome back to the program our friend writer Colin Fleming, whose brand new book, Scrooge, is out and available right now. Colin, good to have you with us. Good afternoon.
Hey, hello again, buddy.
Good to talk with you. My goodness, we've got so much to cover here in the world of the holiday season. How many steps? You've been on a mission lately.
Stairs?
Yeah.
3,000 today. I don't know how good that is. It takes about a half hour to do that. So is that like a sizable workout? Is that like a poor workout? I don't even know.
I would say that a half hour of a fairly intense workout, I would give that 4 stars.
Yeah, you get a good sweat going. It's only like a half mile from where I live. So walk over there, listen to a couple songs en route, and then do my thing. I did take a break today after 2,000 steps because I knew I was just going to be doing the 3,000. But I feel better about myself. I find that when I do it, even when I have a jam-packed day, some of these days I literally don't even stand up from the desk, but I do feel better about myself and just the world in general and all of that when I do the stairs. So take a leaf from my book, good people of Bangor.
And you got to take in a little entertainment over the weekend, too.
I did. I went to Boston Brogues' production of Messiah. And I usually go to at least one Messiah a year, and typically the Handel and Haydn version. But I wasn't able to get to that this year. So I had to go out to this place in Brighton where the only way to get to it was in their new digs, or at least their temporary digs because of COVID, was via a bus. And I don't know how buses work. Like, I wouldn't even know where to get a bus. So I don't know how to travel by bus in Boston. So it was one of those things where I tried to guess what would be the closest, like, T-stop and then walk from there. But you're walking past all of these warehouses and, like, factories, and there's not much lighting. It's kind of a strange place to go. And I went there, and it was, I'm not going to lie, Kimball, I felt good about myself again, too, because I was, like, the only non-octogenarian in the joint, except for the performers. And so it's like in Gatsby. It's like, hello, young sport. It's like, hey, what's up, my guy? How's it going?
Well, let's talk about a number of holiday items on the agenda for today. First of all, let's start. Tell me a little bit about this very powerful work of art by William Holbrook Beard, Santa Claus. This thing is just, that's beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's funny. It's dark. It's urban. It's sooty. And this particular painter, William Holbrook Beard, this is the Victorian era, and he was an American. And normally, if you knew his paintings at the time, he was pretty popular. What was that, like, painting that everyone had? It was like a joke. Like, it was on Roseanne, I remember, in the background, of those dogs. Or Sam loved this on Cheers, of the dogs playing poker.
Right.
One of the dogs is cheating. That's what he painted most of the time. So you'd be, like, seeing this, like a dog or a monkey, like, who was blacksmith. He was, like, hammering at the anvil, and everyone would be like, that's rich. Dogs aren't blacksmiths. And that's what he did. But it's not what he did here. He has Santa and his 8 reindeer, so we don't get Rudolph in this one, flying over some cityscape, and it's a very polluted, congested cityscape where the astral plane is all, it's not like the firmament of stars, it's all soot and blackness and dirt and smog and all that stuff. And Santa is shooting the presents. He's tossing them through a very narrow chimney below. Like, he can't be bothered to stop. This is not the same treatment that the country gets. And it's witty, but it's also like this colored noir painting, too. It's strange. There really isn't any kind of contemporary Christmas painting like what is happening here.
I think it emphasizes the fact that we take for granted that Santa's got a pretty dirty job.
He does, and Santa has, like, this throw, like this blanket over his lap, too, that's billowing out the back. Like, damn, it's cold up here, Blitzen. He sort of has that vibe to it, and his aim is impeccable. Like, you see, like, he can, like, sort of get close in the painting and see, what's that? It's like, oh, it's like airborne candy cane. And there's, like, this very funny, like, note, too, of the thing that's actually going into the chimney, and we see it descending, is an upside-down elfin doll, like, going in headfirst, like, careening, like, look out below. And Santa, he's not smiling. This isn't mirth. It's like, this is business. This is how you do this. set them up and knock them down, and off in the distance we get sort of this nimbus-y light, and there's a warmth to the photo, to the painting rather, on that side. But here within the soot in the urban, and let's not forget like what era this is too. So this is like the early 1860s, and you have all of these factories and all the muckraking that's going to come out and writing at the beginning of the next century and all that. So the world is changing. It's becoming this industrialized world. Mm-hmm. And so Santa is not changing. Santa is a constant. He's a constant out in the snow scene, in the country and all that stuff. And when we think of Santa in like 1830, and he's a constant in this urban environment too.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. From Santa to the Beatles sending Christmas greetings to their fans via vinyl in 1964. I knew they had done this, but I don't think I had ever listened to one before. What a hoot this was.
Yeah, I've written about them. I don't even know who I wrote about them for. A few places, I think, at least two. And I think I did something for Vanity Fair about these once. And so this is the second one. And they did them like throughout their sort of entire fame run. The one from 1963 is the most fun because they're happy to be there. They're like shocked that it's worked out the way that it has. And you get swept up in their enthusiasm. Here, speaking of a jape, they're in a very japing kind of mood where they're in the studio in late October. They were recording this on like December 22nd. And these things went out on flexies. So it was like cheap vinyl that was all bendy and rubbery and stuff like that. And it would go out to members of the fan club. And they've since been reissued, and you can find them all on YouTube. You can actually chart the band's camaraderie and lack thereof via these Christmas flexi discs throughout the years. Like at the end, they're not even recording them together. It's like very white album, but the Christmas flexi version of this. So they're reading in this one. They've had all of the success in 64. It's Ed Sullivan. It's The Conquering of America. It's the Hard Day's Night album and film, all that stuff. That's where we're at. They're working on Beatles for Sale, and they know that they're going to be shooting Help in February of the next year. And so they're thanking the world, really, for where they're at, but they're doing it Beatles style. So they're reading the copy that someone else has clearly written. They've had nothing to do with this. And Lennon's pretty funny. Like, McCartney starts, he's like, hey, it's Paul. It's like, Happy Christmas. All this stuff is great. We don't know what we would be doing without all your love. And you hear Lennon, like, in the background, maybe in the army, perhaps. it's they're kind of these, like, these notes of, you know how, like, at the end of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the reprise, there's that count, and the McCartney is that 1, 2, 3. And you hear Lennon between a couple of the beats say bye. He just sort of squeezes that in, like sort of this ghostly note. That's what he's doing here. And then it's Lennon's turn to read. And they have them saying, like, and thank you for this too. And this was great too. So he's like really creating a huge amount of space between the end of the sentence and the two. So it's awkward every time.
Right.
And they're just schoolboys acting out. And perhaps not surprisingly, like Ringo Starr sounds the most like genuine.
Yes.
He tries to clean
oh, yes.
It up at the end. And that's who he is in now. And that's who he was in the Get Back era and all that stuff. So there he was doing this in the end of 1964, too.
And I wonder if it was scripted for George Harrison to get in the biggest plug for the new movie, which he was happy to say was going to be in color.
Harrison always had an eye on the purse strings. You notice that in Get Back, too. Like, he's always talking about money. He's always like, well, this will be expensive. It's like, well, you're the Beatles. But again, he also didn't have the revenue stream that Lennon and McCartney had because of their songwriting. So he's trying to get the plug in. But we also have to remember, too, that even at this point, they didn't know how long it was going to last. It was supposed to be this ephemeral thing. But that was the thinking, anyway. And so, yeah, they've been big, but it also seemed like Elvis be really big, and he was passé at this point. He was still Elvis, but he wasn't like the Elvis of 1956 and 57, like the Elvis they fell in love with. He was kind of like this joke, this punchline, who made Blue Hawaii and went about with hula girls and was a roustabout and all that stuff. So they didn't know. So they had this other opportunity to do this film, and of course that film wasn't nearly as strong, but it was almost like this vacation, and they knew that they had this vacation coming. They just had to work on their vacation, but I picture them there. You think about this. It's the autumn. It's the English autumn of 64. And you have to get the sleigh bells out and do the jingling and all that stuff. And Lennon busts out the harmonica, which is shortly going to be retired. It's interesting because there's this. And then there's I'm a Loser. And that's really going to be it for the harmonica. It's going to show up sometimes in the 1965 tour in Europe when they perform I'm a Loser, and a couple times in the BBC. But this is one of the last times you'll actually hear him blow into a mouth organ.
Well, we go from the Beatles back a little over 100 years to the Journal of Henry David Thoreau. I could say that you were a modern Thoreau, or I would say that Thoreau was the predecessor to Colin Fleming, because I thought of you immediately when he offered the advice, be cold and hungry and weary.
This is something else. And yes, you're correct. I mean, he's my guy. I mean, I him and Orson Welles, I think, like out of all the people there have ever been, if I were to sit down and, like when I was at Messiah the other night, I was thinking to myself during the concluding Amen chorus, that the only time I feel like I'm interacting with someone of my own species is when I'm experiencing art like that. I feel like that way with Handel, and I feel that way with Thoreau often. And this is a remarkable entry. He's 39 years old. It's from Christmas Day itself in 1856. And he describes these snowbanks and how they blow up against walls, and there's nothing like the snow that blows against walls. He says they're like shells more than anything. Sometimes prows of vessels, also the folds of a white napkin or counterpane dropped over a bonneted head. I mean, that's writing. You'll see people do the MFA thing, and they just pile up the description because they're piling up the word count. They don't really have anything to say. And he has so much to say. When you have so much to say, you end up saying just enough, just the right amount. And he talks about the people he wants to visit and who he hears got like some new spruce and all these things. He never once, but such an entry befitting of the season, he never once mentions Christmas directly.
No.
The word is not in here. It's a rare word in his entire journals, too. A couple Christmases ago, I decided like this was, I got myself something, which I don't normally do, and it was his complete unabridged journals. And it's funny because, like, when I was a kid, my parents went to Borders, and they got me all of In Search of Lost Time by Proust. And the person selling it to them, they told me about it later, was like, oh, why are you doing this to your kid? Like, it was a mean thing. And my mom was like, no, he wanted to, like, really into this. So, like, I sort of think of the Thoreau the same way. And he gets to the end, and this is how he concludes the entry for Christmas that year. And you can live by this, and it's not a literal thing. Take long walks in stormy weather through deep snows in the fields and woods if you would keep your spirits up. Deal with brute nature. Be cold and hungry and weary.
Yeah.
He's saying have purpose. Be driven. Don't cut excuses for yourself. And it's not a weather thing. It's not actually like, okay, time to go out in the woods and freeze my ass off, although that's good for you too. It's more than that. It extends with far greater range. It speaks to anything you might be undertaking that is worth doing. It speaks to connecting with the world and with other people and with yourself. And don't take the easy way. Take the way of consequence and meaning, which ends up feeling easier anyway because it's more rewarding. It makes you better. It makes your life better. It makes your interactions better. It makes your Christmases better.
Yeah, it's so eloquent, deceptively simple, and timeless, too, for those people who say, I want to get away from the commercialization of Christmas, but always fail to do that. Read this. Take Thoreau's advice, and I guarantee you, your holiday will be the most fulfilling one you've had in some time.
I've spent all of the Christmases since 2012 entirely alone. I haven't even talked to anyone on those Christmases. Christmas has always been very difficult for me since my life has fallen apart and then everything I deal with now. And there are times I've been out in the woods and just tramping around and very much in the spirit of what he's writing about here, or I've created on Christmas, or I've worked and I've made this story or a portion of that book, which is the same thing. It's the same idea of the fields and the woods. The stairs are the fields and the woods.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get more urban than the government center stairs. in Boston on the Freedom Trail. But that's exactly what he means. That's what he's talking about. When I'm out there and it's just me, like the other day, it was like 7 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday, and I was out there and it was raining, it was misting, it was just me out there by myself going up and down these stairs. It was such a Woods of Concord setting, even though the ground was hard underfoot. It's just pavement and trash and everything, detritus blowing around. And it's good for the soul. It's soul cleansing. Like Handel is soul cleansing. This is soul cleansing. It's a kind of art, and it's a kind of art that is housed in everybody. And it's just not going to come out. It's not going to be on overt display in the museum. It has to be something that you source from within and put up on your own sort of like personal wall of how you live your life. But it feels so much better. It really does. And that idea of being hungry and wanting, desire, having standards and not just like, fall into something. No, go out and get it.
There's great beauty in that. And I think for those who do it, it's how you achieve a sense of self.
It is. And it's how you achieve a foundation of conscience. And it's how you achieve a code of morality and how you challenge yourself. I wrote about this in the blog, I think it was yesterday, that people, maybe it was today, people are so quick to self-congratulate.
And it was like, I'm very proud of myself, Colin. I'm proud of myself today.
Well, I see people like, I'm so proud that I've made it so far on my own. And I always think, it's not me being cynical, because I'm not a cynical person, but I am a questioning person. Where do you think you've made it to? Like, what exactly have you done? And that doesn't mean that everyone is supposed to go out and, like, write some amazing thing or make some remarkable film or cut Sergeant Pepper, anything like that. But what's your version of that within, like, your particular skill set? Are you going as far as you can go? Are you hungry? Are you driven? And hunger isn't avarice. Hunger is standard. And, again, like I said, it's going for it. So it's... I think Thoreau, I mean, you read one of these entries, and it's like you said, it's simple, but it's not simple. Like, if you said to another writer, like, try and do this, they could spend their life, and they would never come up with this combination of words that hits like this combination of words does.
Let's move from Henry David Thoreau to the Rankin Bass collection, and wonderful, from 1974, a holiday favorite. I love this for some reason. And the animation is not all that great, but something about it, maybe it's the George Gobel narration, but I love 'Twas the Night Before Christmas.
This might surprise you, given my love of Rudolph. And I should say that today I'm not in my bathroom and hallway Herbie is within listening distance, Ooh. So I do not want to court his ire. This is my favorite Rankin Bass special.
Oh, wow.
It came out in 1974. And to me, it was Christmas. The way the animation, it's a little bit cheesy, but it looks like Christmas looks in the mind of a child.
Mm-hmm.
It has the graphics that I feel like play in the child, like cartoon mind version of Christmas. And it is so tuneful. I mean, right? Weren't you hopping around the room?
You're yes.
Like, even the miracle needs that. Like, oh, it's awesome. I love that. And you have this Old Testament, I always like this guy, this Old Testament, vengeful, revenge-bent Santa, who gets these, he's like, "You, this is what you're doing, like, with the notes to me? Like, I didn't really like the tone, so I'm going to boycott your town." And so the premise is that this clockmaker has to build this clock that's going to play this song that's going to cause Santa to bang a Yui in the sky and come back to this town. And the clockmaker lives in a house with a parallel family. It's much like his family. So they're these mice. And one of the sons of the Father Mouse is a doubting Thomas. He's a doubting mouse. So he gums up the works. He messes up the clock. And it goes kerplunk and kerplooey. And that's not what we're looking for here. And he has to learn the true meaning of not just Christmas, but miracles and how they're miracles, and sure, they're impressive, but you can still give them a Wayne Gretzky style assist to help them along.
Finally,
I love it. I watch it a lot. I watch it like in May. I love this one.
Finally, a wonderful version of Lights Out. I think it was from 1937. Three strangers. It takes place ostensibly during the Christmas truce of World War One in 1918. Three strangers on a train for a bit of a break from the war. But what a backstory!
Yes, the war is coming to an end, and their time is essentially done. Their killing time is over. And so you have this train, it's taking these guys off to like a respite. And it's sort of like it's keeping with a Thoreau, this idea of, yes, it's simple, but it's not simple. Like you'd have a hard time coming up with this idea. And that's what you want. We've talked about this before. I was classified as a why didn't I think of that idea? Or a story like that today, a why didn't I think of that? Except I did think of it. And so you have these guys, and there's like a guy from Australia, and there's a French guy, and there's an American from Chicago. And so they invite the American, and he's the last one to show up. And there's not a lot of room on the train, and they end up sharing this cabin together. And they have a toast, and they talk about the war and all this stuff, and how horrible the things they've seen have been. And they sort of take a nap together. They fall asleep. And they all have this same dream where they are the wise men. And so their names are kind of similar to the three wise men and everything. And they go through this like ordeal, and they meet the shepherd, and they meet this person who really pulled out the baby Jesus. He was like the birthing doctor and all this stuff. And he has this tale. It's like, it was a virgin. They're like, what? How's that even possible? And let's follow this star. And they all wake up back again in the train. I love this. I think this is just so well done because it's tiny, it's subtle. And they look at their feet and there's straw amidst their feet and there's some smell in the air. And one of the guys is like, hey, I've been to the Africa and the Middle East, all that stuff. It's myrrh and frankincense. And it's just, again, that idea of a miracle. And it's just straw. Who knows? Whatever the straw could be there for. Someone just like threw it underfoot or there's a horse or whatever. But it's still how they perceive it. And it's how we perceive it. And again, that idea of simple, but no one else would have thought of it.
No, and it's beautifully done. It's very smart. I listened to it Sunday night. The best time to listen to it is clearly at night. And it reminded me of another holiday favorite that you introduced me to, I think, originally, and I watch it every time it's on. It was on TCM again recently, the wonderful short film from Don Siegel, Star in the Night.
Right, from 1945. So just a few years after this, and a variant on that displaced identity or memory or experience kind of theme, where that one's like in the modern time, and then it goes back to restaging in some ways the nativity, the Christmas story that we're also going to get like in the Charlie Brown Christmas special and all that stuff. And I think too that we should note about this Lights Out episode is that there's all this talk that everyone was always so bad. We're progressive now. We're not progressive now. People are just oftentimes trying to be a certain way so as not to have to contend with a mob they can't appease anyway. It's not because it's like some actual modulation of the way the human heart works and it's all different now, nothing like that. If someone in 2021, some fake woke person, some virtue signaler, it's like, oh, I do this, I care about social justice, rubbish, you didn't care about 5 years ago, you're not genuine about it now. Listen to this from 1937, because this is real. And this isn't about color. The guy from Chicago happens to be black. But that's like a different time. And it doesn't matter in this story at all. Like, it's like barely worth mentioning. And you'd think it would have just been like race, 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 race. It's not at all. These are brothers who have never met, who are going to share a train ride and never meet again. And yet they're always going to be connected in this human brotherhood kind of way. And I think people think that didn't exist before. And it always did. And I think it existed a lot more freely and a lot more truly before it acquired all of these different agendas and motivations. It's a very human, a very real very touching Christmas drama.
It is indeed. Lights Out, from 1937. Find it out there on YouTube and lots of other sources as well. Colin Fleming, the new book is called Scrooge. I have pre-ordered mine. I'm told it should arrive no later than January 3rd. I am waiting by the mailbox each day.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll send you a PDF copy. And maybe we can talk about that before Christmas if you get time to read it.
That would be fabulous. Absolutely. Colin, thank you. We'll catch up with you again next Tuesday afternoon.
All right. Sounds good.
Colin Fleming here every Tuesday on Downtown. Visit his website, colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog as well.